Now, populist and nationalist parties have seen a lot of success lately, most recently in Italy, where far-right populist parties scored big successes in national elections. And in some countries, populist leaders have taken office and started to dismantle the levers of government, consolidating power and punishing their enemies. Think places like Turkey, Russia, and Hungary, to name a few. Our next guest sees this as a disturbing trend around the world and here in the United States. And with a growing sense of frustration in traditional political parties, he says people are losing patience with representative government and individual rights and more willing to accept authoritarian leadership. Yasha Monk is a lecturer on government at Harvard University, columnist at Slate.com, and host of The Good Fight podcast. His new book is The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. Yasha, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, before we get into the spread of these populist movements, you say one big precondition here is a perception among a lot of people that the establishment or the political elites aren't serving the needs of the people. And you say that perception is rooted in reality. How so?
Well, look, for a long time, people didn't love politicians. They didn't completely trust what's going on in Washington, D.C. But from 1930 to 1965, the living standard of the average American doubled. From then till 1985, it doubled again. And since 1985, it's been flat, essentially been stagnant. Changes how people think about politics. Now they say, you know what, I've worked pretty hard all my life. I didn't have that much to show for it. So let's try something new. How bad could things get?
So talk about the scope of the spread of populist movements, Yasha.
Yeah, so what we're seeing is all of these politicians and political movements that really challenge the most fundamental aspects of our political system gaining a lot.
I'm going to jump in. We have a bad connection, Yasha, so I'm going to have our producer reconnect with you. Hang up for just a moment, and we'll have the producer give you a call. We are talking to Yasha Monk, lecturer on government at Harvard University. He's a columnist at Slate.com and host of the Good Fight podcast. We're talking about his new book. It's called The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. We'll get him back on the line in just a few moments. You can call in with your questions and thoughts on this idea at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page as you see populist movements and populism as a political tactic do better and better in countries around the world. What do you think? Are you worried? Are you hopeful? 800-642-1234, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to our guests who we've got a better connection. Yasha, are you there?
I'm here. Okay. The connection's better this time around.
I think I'm hearing you better now. So I start again with the rise of populist movements around the world. Talk about how widespread this is.
So it's very widespread. When you look at Europe, for example, the average vote share of a populist movement in 2000 was 8%. By now, it is 25%. And what's important about these movements is they don't just say, we want to change up how politics is done. They don't just say, hey, there's a lot of things that are wrong with the current political elite. They actually say that they alone truly represent the people. And that anybody who disagrees with them is illegitimate, is a traitor, is an enemy of the people. So that's why it makes me worried about the stability of democracy. Because we have to have agreement, not on every public policy, but on the basic rules and norms and institutions would make our system work.
And that rise of these populist parties, as you point out, it's coming, especially in Europe, with a real lack of support or decline in support for the long-term traditional parties, right?
Yes, absolutely. So what you see, for example, in Italy, where there was a very interesting election a week ago, is that there had been a populist prime minister, Silvio Berlusconi, who weakened the independence of the judiciary, who kept attacking media in extreme form. He was actually repudiated in 2011, lost a lot of popularity, had to resign from office in disgrace, was even sentenced for paying to have sex with a minor. And yet, 7 years on, he's back. He's the kingmaker in Italian politics once again. And there's other populist parties and movements that are even stronger than him now. In fact, between them, these three movements now have close to two-thirds of a vote, raising real questions about what's going to be happening in Italian politics and in European politics of the euro in the years to come.
You write that one of the key elements of a populist message is offering very often simple solutions to what are very complex problems. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, look, the stop clock is right twice a day. I think populists tend to be right four or five times a day, and the analysis, they often channel real frustrations that people have. They point to things that really are a problem. One of them, for example, is that our politics is not sufficiently responsive to people's views, that the rich and big corporations have too much influence over our politics. So they exploit that anger and right in part of the diagnosis, but the solution is always the same. They say everything is actually simple. You can solve everything through common sense as long as you have a great populist spokesperson, a great populist hero who actually is able to speak for the people. And so once they get into office, they tend to concentrate power into their own hands, to delegitimize independent institutions, the media, courts, and so on and so forth. And eventually, it becomes impossible to dislodge a democratically elected prime minister or president through democratic means. And that's happening, for example, in Hungary at the moment, which looked like a stable democracy 5 or 10 years ago and now no longer has free and fair elections.
And scapegoating is another part of the story. Part of the simple solution, often you write, is that there is some very particular group of people to blame. How do you see that playing out in different countries?
Absolutely. So, look, there's many reasons why the living standards of average Americans have stagnated. Some of them have to do with actual political choices, with, tax laws that favor the rich while not doing much for the middle class. But there's also more complicated causes of it. There's automation. There's the fact that technological progress is not as fast as it was in the 50s and 60s. Well, what populists say is, all you need to do is to drain the swamp. All you need to do is to throw out the current elite, and I promise you everything is going to get better. Now, once populists are in power, they have something to explain. Because you know what? Things don't miraculously get better overnight. They say, hey, who knew that things could be so complicated? Who knew that healthcare could be so complicated? Who knew that the Middle East could be so complicated? So instead of admitting that they've made a mistake, that they had an overly simplistic prescription, they start to say, you know why I'm not delivering on you? I'm not delivering for you because there are all of these sinister minorities who have too much of an influence in our politics. You know why I'm not delivering for you? I'm not delivering for you because actually the press is criticizing me all of the time, and that's all fake news, that's all sabotage. You know I'm not delivering for you because the judges are trying to uphold the Constitution, but they're actually enemies of the people.
This isn't as surprising, say, in a fledgling democracy, the post-Soviet world that didn't have that much experience with electoral democracy. You're worried that even in some of the longest-running representative governments, France, the United States, elsewhere, that even those long-running institutions might not survive populism.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, I think that a few years ago, most political scientists in this country would have said a candidate who threatens to lock up his political adversary, who says that he will keep voters in suspense about whether he'll accept the outcome of the election, would never be acceptable as a president of his country, that a majority of people would never vote for a candidate like that. Well, we've seen that change. I think even a year ago, even once Donald Trump was in office, most people in the United States would have said, well, if he really attacks the FBI, the Department of Justice, institutions which people on both sides of the aisle have long respected in a fundamental way, people aren't going to turn on those institutions. Well, we've seen that turned out to be wrong. Now, look, obviously the United States has a deeper democratic tradition than Hungary and Poland. It has more checks and balances. We're seeing some tremendous activity to try and rescue and support these institutions. But it's worth remembering that 5 years ago, most political scientists, most experts of Central Europe, thought that democracy was safe in countries like Hungary as well. And now we're seeing it recede very rapidly.
Do you see an almost international populist movement? You see Putin in Russia supporting nationalist groups in France and elsewhere. Steve Bannon was just talking to the French National Front and giving shout-outs to leaders in Hungary and other countries you're worried about. Is there an international scene where populists are supporting each other across borders?
Yeah, there is what I would call the liberal international, people who have very similar views who have a real tendency towards strongman rule. And what's worrying about it is that they're starting to create both systemic alternatives to democracy and a playbook by which to weaken it. So Viktor Orban a few years ago said, I'm against liberal democracy. What I want is hierarchical democracy, in which the prime minister really gets to decide what happens throughout the country, gets to institute his own judges, gets to put his people into all of the main state agencies. And he's become very popular by giving big handouts to his own supporters, by portraying the Hungarian nation as being under threat, for example, by U.S. citizens, by refugees, but also just by Jews and other minorities. And he has managed to use that rhetoric in order to make people rally around the flag. Now, what's striking about Donald Trump is that he is doing some of those same things, but he hasn't done it in a very disciplined way. For example, he hasn't really delivered on some of the people who had deep economic frustration who voted for him in the first place. And my fear is that if he becomes wiser, if he actually learns on the job, which he so far seems to have proven resistant to.
We're talking to Yascha Mounk. His new book is The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. He says populist movements in the United States and around the world are threatening representative governments and individual liberties. You can join us with your comments and questions at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the growing appeal of populist movements around the world here in the country? We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Yascha Mounk is with us, author of The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. He says the rise of populist movements in countries around the world is a threat to representative governments and individual liberty. Countries from Hungary and Russia to France and Italy to the United States. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Do you share his concerns? Are you worried about the survival of representative governments like the United States? 800-642-1234 is the number. Go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Lake Mills. Mike, hi.
Hi. Hey, thanks for having me on. I discuss this a lot with the younger folks at work and out at the college about this populist movement. And I bring the, we'll say, the catapulting of this movement back to about 2008, a little before the worldwide economic collapse. And I attribute it to conservatives who have always, during elections, appealed to the Nazis, that have always appealed to populists, that have always appealed to white supremacists for votes.
Mike, thanks for the call. Yascha, Mike sees ancestors here, at least political rhetoric of the past leading up to our current populist moment. What do you think?
I think that's absolutely right. One of the important things to realize is that, you know, we always imagine the moment when democracies perish as, you know, Nazis marching in the street, doing the Hitler salute, you know, with black boots and torches that are on fire. That's not normally how it works. What you see instead is a slow ratcheting up of rhetoric against the existing political system, this slow way in which our discourse becomes more and more extreme, in which we start seeing people on the other side of the political divide as enemies rather than adversaries. And that creates the opening for people to amass more and more power in their own hands. And we're seeing some of those things in the United States right now.
Let's bring on another caller. Elena is with us in Milwaukee. Elena, hi.
Hi. I'm really worried about democracy. So I see a lot of people joining grassroots groups. I think, you know, the small movement is starting, and I think that people are paying attention because there's so much going on to suppress the voter.
Elena, thanks for the call. And Yascha, Elena takes us into the second half of your book, The Response to the Rise of the Populist Movement. And she mentioned grassroots groups starting. What do you see as being, if people want to resist the rise of populism, what is an effective form of resistance?
So the first thing we absolutely need to do is to make sure that populists don't win election the second or third time. So, you know, what you see in countries like Poland and Hungary and so on is that when populists gain election again, they start to destroy the political system, and it's very dangerous. So I think that, you know, opposing people who don't accept the most basic rules and norms of the political system through political campaigning and other forms of political activity is absolutely crucial. But we need to go beyond that. People don't accept the democratic system at the moment because they have deep frustrations with how things have been going, because they feel that the system isn't responsive enough to them and that they need to have more material progress and so on. So actually showing that we can have a moderate politics that is not extremist, but that deals with those things, that gives people hope for a better future, is just as important in making people win trust in the political system again.
That sounds like it's easier said than done, because the reason we're at this moment is because political leaders either haven't tried to do these things or haven't been able to agree on the best paths to get there, right?
Absolutely. When I look at the 2016 election, it seems to me like a contest between an extremist politics of change and a moderate politics of the status quo. And what you see in those circumstances is that people might choose the extremist politics of change, not because most Americans are extremists, but because they want an actual promise of things getting better. So I think that, you know, moderate political parties, concretely United States, the Democrats, need to actually offer a better vision of how politics can be done in a way that delivers for them, that isn't giving in to some of the political extremes, but that's actually putting forward a realistic vision of how people are going to have more money in their pockets, how the political system is going to respond to what they want, and so on and so forth.
Speaking of faith in the democratic system, you cite some surveys that have been done over a bunch of years showing that more and more people, even younger people, especially younger people, say it's not necessarily important to live in a democracy, and people being more open to the idea that a military government or authoritarian government is an acceptable form of government.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have a lot more young people saying that it's not important to them to live in a democracy than old people. You have 20 years ago, 1 in 16 Americans saying that they like the idea of army rule. Now it's 1 in 6. You have a real increase across Europe in the number of people who say they want a strongman leader who doesn't have to bother with parliament and elections. So this is one of the signs that people aren't just unhappy with particular governments, with particular politicians, but that they're unhappy with the political system in itself.
Do you think we're in a generation now where the people who fought in World War II are now passing away? They're not part of the body politic as much anymore. We don't have that direct experience of the worst that populist nationalism has to offer. Is there a historical memory problem?
Yes, absolutely. People used to say, hey, I can see that there's bad things in our system, but I also see how bad things were in fascist countries, in communist countries. And so I'm not going to make too many experiments. I'm not going to risk seeing our system be destroyed and something potentially quite terrible taking its place. At this point, people say, you know what? I can see all the bad things in the system. I don't have much imagination of what an alternative would look like. So, you know, let's try things. And as I was saying earlier, it doesn't take people to actually have a principled preference for an alternative to democracy for that kind of thing to arise. It's enough for them to say, I'm so fed up with the system, I'm not really fearful of what else might happen, so let's give somebody pretty extreme a shot. How bad could things get?
Do you see a response, an effective response to populism starting to emerge around the world?
Yes, I think you're starting to see people recognize at least the extent of the danger. I think you see a lot of courageous individuals and a lot of great civil society organizations trying to stand up in a nonpartisan way for the things that we should all agree on, which is the basic rules and norms of our political system. But you also see difficulty of opposition movements actually uniting, leaving some of the policy differences aside in order to concentrate on the things that they have in common. And once populists are in power, they have access to tremendous levers of control. They can put pressure on media organizations. They can start to put their own political cronies and their own strengthen relatives into positions of power in independent bureaucratic institutions and so on. So it's an uphill battle. And I think in the United States, we should be grateful for the fact that for now, we retain our ability to fight for our convictions and fight for our political system, and that makes it all the more urgent that we do that now.
And we'll leave it there. Yasha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Sorry about the bad line.
That's Yasha Monk. He's a lecturer on government at Harvard University, a columnist at Slate.com, and senior fellow in the political reform program at New America. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the issues that he raised. You can do that over at the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know what you think there.